good afternoon, and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2, talking to you about healthcare and fitness. And I'm also usually taking your phone calls, as I will do today. Oh, I have such a fun show for you today. Today's show is an interview with Robert Sapolsky, professor of biology and neuroscience at Stanford University and author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. He has a newer book also, The Trouble with Testosterone, and other essays on the biology of the human predicament, which we will discuss on February 3rd during the pledge drive. So if you loved him today, of course we haven't interviewed him yet, but I think you will. You'll love him even more in February. So today we're going to talk about why zebras don't get ulcers. I'll be opening up the phone lines for your participation at around 240 or so, and that number for everybody in or out of the area code is 510-848-4425, and I'll give it out when we're ready to go with your phone calls. Also, for those of you who may want a tape of today's show or any other in the series, or if you need to get a hold of me during the week, you can call me during normal business hours at 707-769-1458. I'm not going to do an editorial. I want to get right into our show because we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about stress. Robert, are you with us?
Yep.
Okay. Forgive me. Maybe I should say Dr. Sapolsky.
Okay.
After reading your books, I feel like calling you Robert, though, because I feel like your books are very intimate. Robert Sapolsky is a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant and a 1994 Los Angeles Book Prize finalist for Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. He's a regular contributor to two magazines, The Sciences and Discover magazines, and Dr. Sapolsky teaches biology and neuroscience at Stanford University. He also spends part of the year doing field work at the Institute of Primate Research in Kenya. So thank you again for taking this time with us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I sent you a tape of a show I did about stress because I wanted you to know that I had, albeit rather incompetently compared to what you do in your book, have discussed on the show that there are different forms of stress, some of them being good and some traumatic, but that all forms of stress, if they become chronic, are expensive for the body. So I wanted you to share your metaphor of the two elephants on a seesaw to describe what happens to homeostasis under stress.
Okay, so you want to start off technically here?
Well, except the elephants are such a good way to do it.
Okay, back to ninth grade biology. I guarantee everybody out there at some point or other during that year had a term that they hopefully have not thought about since then, which is the notion of homeostasis. This business about being in homeostatic balance, having an ideal body temperature, having an ideal amount of sugar in your bloodstream, ideal this or that. Our goal, our physiological aim is to be in homeostatic balance. And the way we usually do that is, metaphorically, we've got some seesaw that's perfectly balanced with a little bit of blood pressure control and a little bit of your kidneys doing that and a little bit of brain doing the other, and everything's nice and balanced. What happens with chronic stress is, in effect, huge forces are blowing at your body designed to knock you out of homeostatic balance, which is basically what stress is about. And what the stress response is about is what you do with your body to try to keep that seesaw balanced. And what stress-related disease, where that emerges from with chronic stress, is you do it chronically and your body gets less and less subtle and less coordinated and less adept at this. And after a while, you're balancing the seesaw with two elephants on either side. And the reason why that's not a good thing is because you wear out the seesaw, because the elephants are big and expensive, and there are stress-related diseases of basically putting too much wear and tear on the system. And you get sick also because elephants take a huge amount of energy to hire them to keep seesaws in balance, and you know they're consuming tons of food, and that's not a silly metaphor. During the stress response, your stress response emergency system takes a huge amount of energy, and that's being consumed instead of going for more useful stuff like growing or repairing tissue. And the final thing is, when you know you've got two elephants around, they make a mess of things.
Mm-hmm.
They leave big piles and they eat up all the lawn furniture or things like that. And you know, there's a metaphorical equivalent there as well. If you constantly try to maintain homeostatic balance with big, unsubtle stress responses, you make a mess of things along the way. And basically, that's what stress-related disease is about.
Well, you know, also it's clear from your book that most things that our bodies do are done for a reason. So maybe we should also mention what it is that's good about a stress response. What is it for?
Oh, it's fabulous. It's perfect if you get stressed the way you're supposed to, which is some predators leapt out and ripped your stomach half open and you still have to sprint across the savannah to get away. If you get stressed the way 99% of the beasts do on this planet, which is dealing with some sort of short-term physical crisis, if you get stressed in this normal mammalian kind of way, everything your body is doing in the next 30 seconds is perfect, exactly what you want to do to survive. You mobilize energy from storage sites, you increase your blood pressure so you can deliver the energy as rapidly as possible, you turn off everything in your body that's not essential for the next 30 seconds, you got better things to do than digest or thicken your uterine walls or make sperm or extend your long bones or make antibodies. Anything that you can do tonight, do it tonight if there is a tonight. You shut down digestion, you shut down growth, you shut down immunity. All of this makes perfect sense for short-term crisis. And where we get in trouble is we turn on the exact same system, worrying about 30-year mortgages and worrying about the ozone layer, and that doesn't make any sense from the standpoint of evolution.
Since you mentioned evolution, one of the things that's remarkable, whenever I study science, I'm constantly so sort of taken with the interrelatedness of everything. I mean, it's so churchy to me. I mean, it is. I mean, I don't need any pseudoscience. The real stuff is really phenomenal. And one of the things that's sort of chilling is to read about the old part of the brain, which is working during stress, and how it presents this sort of cascade of hormones. Do you want to talk a little bit about the nervous system and the limbic brain and all of that?
Okay, I'll try to do it real painlessly.
Oh, okay.
just in terms of, I'm sure people don't want to get inundated with a whole lot of hormones.
We don't want to stress them, and we said it would be funny. So.
Okay. We all know the main hormone of the stress response, which is adrenaline. It turns out there is half a dozen other important ones as well. There's a bunch of hormones you turn off during stress. And basically, it's your hypothalamus that's responsible for that. That's sitting at the base of your brain. It pushes around your pituitary, tells it what to do. That's real critical for stressful events like you've been injured and you're hemorrhaging, and your hypothalamus is the thing responsible for kicking you into gear. On the other hand, if you're getting stressed because you're some male wildebeest and some other wildebeest is, snoring and pawing and stinking up the place with his territorial displays and all that sort of stuff, you use an additional part of the brain called the limbic system, which is involved in emotion, and that's critical to stress involving, seasonal mating and territorial disputes and things that are emotional and anticipatory rather than the sort of mechanical, oops, you've lost 11% of your blood volume after this injury, quick turn on, this restorative system or that. By the time you get to us, there's a third layer that's real critical, because we don't get stressed just because we're hemorrhaging or because somebody's challenging our territory. We can think about April 15th. We can think about blind dates. We can think about mortality, these incredibly cognitive things, and your cortex kicks in then and convinces your hypothalamus, this is so stressful, it should do the same exact thing that you would do if you had just gotten hemorrhaged by a saber-toothed tiger. Mm-hmm. We can turn on the whole system just with thought.
Yeah, and it's a very old part of the brain. It's one of the parts of our bodies that we don't change. It stays there from our youth. So the concept, which is albeit maybe on the edge of being pseudoscientific, but the idea of cellular memory or old memories maybe have to do with habituated responses to stress.
I don't think that's pseudoscience. I think all of us in the Bay Area know a good example of that. Sit somewhere and have some big truck come roaring by and have it vibrate the room, and any of us who were here during the earthquake in 1989 right. are going to have just the starts of the stress response, 15-second experience back then, and you've got a really good memory mm-hmm. of that physiologically.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on to the effect that stress has in terms of disease and development and sex hormones and all that, but before we move on, it's also interesting that stress blocks pain, that we have this nice thing that happens to enable us to keep moving, which is that we don't feel any pain. We sort of go into shock. This makes me wonder whether we are the only animals that deliberately hurt ourselves. It seems like most animals use the stress response wisely, and the rest of us kind of seek it out or deliberately go past pain, that sort of thing. Do other animals do that?
Sorry, getting over the flu here. In some sort of psychopathological hey, oh no, live on the radio and I'm calling.
Do you need to get some water or something? I can sing or something.
I'll flail along. In some psychopathological circumstances, and a lot of what people debate is there an animal model for depression? Is there an animal model for this or that psychiatric disorder? And you will often see animals injuring themselves as part of it, but that's very rare stuff. Mm-hmm. When you get to the range of stuff that I think you're talking about, you're seeing something very distinctly human and often something very sort of culturally bound. It's not a very typical human experience to voluntarily go out and run 26 miles in a day. Yet if you're in the right culture that happens to value marathon runs, you'll go out and do that. And that's clearly a weird thing to do for a hominid. In other cultural settings, people pierce themselves, people mutilate, people tattoo in the name of sort of cultural rites. And again, that's not a typical mammalian thing. Put it in the right context, though, and this is not injury, this is culture. And I think that stress-induced blocking of pain becomes pretty relevant then.
Let's talk about the effect that stress has on us physically when it's chronic. And one of the things that probably seems pretty important is the effect that stress has on the developing human.
Yeah, and one of the themes of the stress response is shut down everything that's not essential because you've got to get away from the tiger in the next 30 seconds. And one of the themes of stress-related disease is if, for psychological reasons, you decide every single traffic jam, etc., is like a tiger chasing you, you're going to get sick, etc. Never more do you see that principle than when you see a kid, a developing organism. All a kid is one big long-term building project. And if the physiology of the stress response is every single day to say, don't grow, don't repair tissue, don't plan for the future because we've got a crisis right now, do it tomorrow, all sorts of things don't work well in kids. And probably the most dramatic example of that is this totally bizarre disease that endocrinologists will see once in a career, a disease of kids who stop growing for reasons of psychological stress. And this is sometimes called stress dwarfism, psychogenic dwarfism, psychosocial dwarfism. These are kids who were years behind the normal growth rates, no disease, no malnutrition, no parasites. You check their bloodstream, no growth hormone. You give them synthetic versions of that hormone, still doesn't work. The whole system is shut down. And you check around, and that's often when you see some horrendously psychologically stressful thing going on.
Now, you're careful to say in the book that we're talking about phenomenally stressful things like being locked in a closet for most of your childhood, the normal kinds of my parents, were inept at raising me, so now I have trauma kind of thing. Although traumatic childhoods that most humans tend to have, just because we make a lot of mistakes to learn, still have an effect. And so on adults and on children, as you're saying, because stress is so expensive, it interrupts their development. And it, among other things, really mucks up your energy production, your capacity to produce energy properly. This may lead then to cardiovascular disease and diabetes.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk a little bit about what happens to our capacity to make energy, why stress is bad for our energy production?
Well, a good thing with that is to rely on a metaphor, because it actually kind of makes sense. You've got a bundle of excess money, and, very few of us in these days in that situation take it in the form of cash and, stuff it into our mattress. What we do instead is we stick it away in some bank, and often what you'll do is make some agreement, great, I'll put this money into a long-term interest fund, I'll stick it in there for 2 years, I promise not to touch it, in exchange I get oodles of interest, and you usually also agree that if you change your mind and you take the money out early, you pay a penalty. And in the exact same way, what you do when you have energy surplus is you stick it away in the bank. You stick it in your liver, in your fat cells. You stick it away for some project next spring in a particular form, a storage form of energy. And every time you change your mind and you run to the bank and say, I'm in this complete neurotic tizzy worrying about the ozone layer, so I need to empty out all my energy stores as if I'm being chased by a lion. I need to empty out the savings account and turn it into cash in my pocket. In the same way, you pay a penalty. The process of mobilizing energy from your liver, from your fat, winds up being inefficient, and you lose a certain percentage of it just in the process of transferring stuff. And if every single day you get into this whole anxious state because of chronic psychological stress, you're constantly emptying out your storage sites, and each time you do that, that's a very inefficient thing to do with your energy. You squander a big chunk of it. And it's not surprising that when we're stressed chronically, we're exhausted. It's not just because we're sleeping poorly. We're wasting a huge percentage of our potential energy depositing and withdrawing and depositing and withdrawing, and every step there's a little bit of a penalty.
I think we might want to talk about, let me just briefly ID the show, because some people may have just tuned in. It's Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with biology and neuroscientist and professor of neuroscience at Stanford, Robert Sapolsky, and we're talking about his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. So we're talking about stress, and we'll go to about 2:40, and then we'll probably start taking phone calls. Hostility and helplessness, you know, who gets ulcers and who gives them?
Yeah.
Under this one, I'd like to talk a bit about the idea of habituated responses, like learned helplessness, and the fact that it can be retrained a bit.
Well, if you look at stress-related diseases, and often, well, that takes a little bit of redefining. There's not a whole lot of diseases that are caused by stress, but there's a lot that are worsened by it once you have them, and there's a lot of diseases that you're more likely to get when you're under stress, and you come up with a whole list of them, and it's pretty convincing science these days. Numerically, probably the number one on the list there is depression. Depression is an incredibly devastating disease. I don't mean we all get depressed and feel crummy for a few days now and then when something poorly happens. I mean a totally crippling psychiatric disorder that gets 15 to 20% of us over the course of a lifetime. Depression is the archetypical stress-related disorder. You can't make any sense of it without seeing what stress has to do with it. And one of the most sort of informative ways of thinking about what depression is something called learned helplessness. You can see this in animal models of depression, and you can see this in human depression as well. Learned helplessness, depression cognitively, is the point where we do not even bother with a coping response. Something stressful, something challenging happens in the world around us, and we don't even bother trying to cope because it's not going to work. What's the use? Nothing ever works for me. I don't deserve to have it work anyway. Whatever set of sort of cognitive distortions we have. Psychologically, what people sense that's about often is one big trauma sometime early in life, and you have overgeneralized, and you've decided not only was that a circumstance where I had no control, no outlets, no whatever, but you know what? That's the whole world. I never have any control. I never have any predictability, and that turns into a worldview that's very depressive in flavor. Overwhelmingly, what that's about is circumstances of stress where most organisms would find some means of coping, some means of control, some means of outlets, and for reasons of this psychological distortion, this cognitive distortion, you can't pull it off anymore. Overwhelmingly, depression is a disease of, in the face of stress, you don't even try coping because what's the use?
Yeah, and there's lots of animal studies on this, but it's pretty compelling. The thing that seems to make the difference is when an animal or a human has a sense that either pushing the lever gets a predicted response, like they have control over their situation, or that despite the fact that things are not so good, it looks like they're getting slightly better instead of slightly worse.
Exactly.
Yeah, that hope is, in fact, very important for us.
And that's often, say, what cognitive therapy is about. The person who, yes, had some legitimate trauma when they were younger and someone rejected them or lost a parent or who knows what, and now their worldview is you can't trust anybody, no one will ever love me, whatever distortion there is. Often what the therapy is about is doing these little experiments of taking a sort of tiny baby step of discovering that actually you do have control in this circumstance. That same awful thing is not going to happen again. You kind of rebuild the person's ability to see that what they do in the world actually has a consequence, and stressors are not these tidal waves that just wash over them.
Yeah. Going back to the sort of specific kinds of diseases that are made worse by stress, what I mentioned at the start of this was this issue of hostility, you know, type A type people who are really just perpetually stressed people. I've talked on the show about going back to the energy system that, you know, under stress your body is preparing you to run. So you've got the blood going to your legs and not a whole lot of blood going to your internal organs. And in fact, also, if you continually exhaust your adrenal cortex, you get to the point where your mitochondria, your energy-producing cells, become really stupid, and don't even know how to burn fat as fuel anymore, and they start relying on sugar, and then you eat too much sugar, and then the fat cells do this thing, and you end up with diabetes, or you end up with cardiovascular disease because your arteries are perpetually starved, and you can get, you know, digestive and gut problems. So the issue of, I mean, one of the things I found useful about your book is that I think it forever changed that moment where I have a decision to make about whether this is worth getting aggravated about. It really did. You know, even though I'd read all the research, or no, I shouldn't say all, that makes me sound like I'm amazing. I've read a lot of research about stress, but it was something about the way that you presented it, both with the humor and the practicality of it, that made me feel like, boy, when I'm sitting behind the wheel of the car and somebody cuts me off, who cares? You know, so there's something about making decisions because, in fact, as you say, in the long term, it both in the way that you age and in the way that you develop as a human being and in the development of these diseases, you know, you're capable of making these things worse, and you're capable of predetermining, but setting yourself up for it. So what was my question, I guess? I guess I'm just trying to go back to this idea of people who have these driving... And I think I'm thinking about decisions people can make. They're listening to the show. You know, I'm thinking, what kind of decisions can you make here if you have a type A personality? You know what I'm saying?
Well, one of the encouraging things about all this is, you know, amid this very convincing literature, that certain personality types, certain temperaments... certain ways of looking at the world definitely make you more likely to get stress-related diseases, cardiovascular problems, gastrointestinal, you know, the whole array you've been talking about. This stuff's not set in stone. You can change. There's a wonderful, wonderful group up in San Francisco at UCSF, the people who first originated the type A concept. A cardiologist named Meyer Friedman, who's got an institute there, built around the fact that type A is not forever, the right sort of counseling, and it affects your blood pressure, and it affects your cholesterol levels, and it affects your likelihood of getting your next heart attack or your first one, that sort of thing. These things are not set in stone. Very little in biology falls under the rubric of, oops, it's a gene, forget it, you can't change anything. That's not what genetics is about, and that's not what biology is about. And in this realm, there's lots of room in which you can change the way you look at things. You know, you get gored by an elephant, your blood pressure is going to go up. You pick the wrong line in Safeway, and the Safeway, it's not at all clear that your blood pressure is going to go up. And some people who habitually view that as some total pain in the neck provocation, and off goes their cardiovascular system, they can change. Any of us can.
That leads me to my next question. I know you want to talk about this because you talk about it a fair amount in the book. There is a wave of people who are discussing the relationship of attitude to illness, and I know you have very strong opinions, so I'd like you to have at it.
Well, let's see. I will tread carefully here.
You don't have to, actually.
Okay.
Just, you know, if you just don't use any specific names, maybe, so we don't get sued.
Here, let me have my lawyer sit in my lap here.
Well, you already wrote the book and used names, so I assume you've already been through this.
Well, okay. What the issue we're getting at is, you know, amid there being lots of links between stress and what diseases you get, stress management and what diseases you are less likely to get or less likely to be severe, and over hitting this notion that a lot of the diseases we get now in the West are not diseases of, oh no, you know, cholera infecting the water supply, everybody's dead 72 hours later. Instead, we've got these westernized diseases that are very sensitive to our psychological makeup and our social setting and, you know, this whole song and dance. And it's a very, very powerful organizing principle for thinking about westernized disease. Nevertheless, there's some real scary diseases out there that probably don't have anything to do with stress. And it's real important to get people thinking about that for two reasons. Because if you come down with one of those diseases, they're bad enough without you thinking in terms of, oh, if only I hadn't been uptight my entire life, I wouldn't have disease X now. And even more importantly, what you do at that point, how much you can expect stress management techniques and things of that sort to actually have an impact on the disease. And the disease overwhelmingly that falls in this area, and I really try to dissect the subject in the book, is cancer. Cancer, the evidence is overwhelming when you look at humans. Cancer's got nothing to do with stress. There has never been a solid study showing that stress is associated with the onset of cancer. And when you look at the types of cancers that humans get, there is virtually no evidence that stress has anything to do with how fast the tumor grows. And all of the careful science shows that And it is so important to get people thinking that, because really the last thing you want to have is somebody dying of cancer and they've got to think on top of it, oh, I could have prevented it if only I had had different values in my life. Mm. You know, that's not good medicine, and it's not good ethics.
No, and it's very prevalent in the alternative medicine community, which I feel I am a part of, unfortunately, is participating in a glut of information about how much we participate, and we sort of forget about the fact that there are things that are out of our control. We can change our attitude once we're in the process of dealing with an illness in terms of how much we learn from the experience, but causative. It's interesting, too. I had a very funny experience with this because I went and had a procedure done, which I have to do because I have a family history of cancer, so I had one of those nasty things where they send something up one of your cavities. Because I am very sensitive to drugs and chemicals, I thought that I would do this without anesthesia because I thought that, you know, I would, you're laughing already, because I thought I'd have an easier time recovering from it if my liver wasn't loaded up with Valium and Demerol. I learned a very important thing from this. I thought, since I had meditated for 25, 30 years, that I could breathe into this and I could deal with it. And what I discovered was that it was a far more stressful experience without the medication, and I hurt myself much more doing it without the medication, to say nothing of what I did to the technicians. it really slapped this thing in my face about the kinds of things that we hang on to when we sort of get caught up in being too alternative, that we sort of sometimes lose the forest for the trees. That stress itself is something that we should protect ourselves from if we can do it in a healthful way, which I think we can. We're going to take a brief musical break. When we come back, I want to talk about your studies with the baboons in Africa and about what we learned about ourselves from them. I am health integration specialist Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with author and neuroscientist and biologist Robert Sapolsky, and we're talking about why zebras don't get ulcers. We're talking about stress. We're going to talk about baboons when we come back from this brief break. Hang on. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. That was the penguin music from Bug Music, and the penguins were a little late getting here, so I apologize for that. They were late, and it's the penguins' fault. They're too casual. They need to be under more stress. We actually are on the phone, all of us, with Dr. Robert Sapolsky, neuroscientist, biology professor at Stanford, and author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, A Guide to Stress, Stress-Related Diseases, and Coping, published by Freeman. Sapolsky is spelled, are you ready, guys? Sapolsky, Sapolsky. Dr. Sapolsky does research every year in Kenya with baboons, and he talks about it in the book. Your studies of baboons seem to point to a flood of survival of the fittest behavior and a drought of empathy. Are we genetically predisposed to push out the weakest members?
Definitely not.
Oh, good.
I think sort of these social Darwinist pictures of survival of the fittest has been sort of surpassed in recent years in thinking about sort of evolution of social behavior, especially primate social behavior. We primates, we social mammals, do some real nasty, competitive, aggressive things in the name of passing on our genes. At the same time, we do some very altruistic, self-sacrificing things in some cases. Mostly what people have learned is context is real important.
Well, that's interesting. So you're saying that because in the book, the baboons are being so nasty to each other, even though the conditions are good, they're still, one of the things we learn from them is that people who express their discomfort and their stress, people who are expressors, are much healthier and have less glucocorticoid steroids coursing through their bloodstream than the ones who take it and are repress their feelings. So expressiveness is part of what we learned, and fortunately we don't all just turn on the weakest member and give them a kick. Some of us, have other ways of releasing those things.
Yeah, one of the truisms in stress management is you don't want to get an ulcer in order to avoid getting one. And, it's often very helpful to dump on somebody smaller. That is a basic and rather unpleasant mammalian thing to do, but you know, there's other stress outlets we can fall on also.
Why did you choose baboons?
Ironically, these are great animals to study if you want to understand sort of human westernized stress. The particular population I study is a wild troop living in the Serengeti in East Africa, and this is a fabulous place to live if you're a baboon. These guys work maybe 3-4 hours a day for their day's calories. There's not a high mortality rate amongst the infants. There's not a high predation rate. And what you wind up getting, what you wind up getting is a consequence very similar to what we live. You know, none of us get ulcers because we've got to wrestle with somebody in the supermarket for canned food items or, like, have an axe fight over a parking spot. We've got this wonderful westernized luxury. We're ecologically buffered enough that we can devote our energies to psychological and social stress. And, you know, out there in the real world of real animals, these are some of the only folks around who do the same thing.
They really do, too.
They really do.
It's
3-4 hours a day to get your calories. That's 8-9 hours of sunlight every day to be competitive and Machiavellian and maneuvering and machinating and all of that. And overwhelmingly, if you're some baboon in the Serengeti and you're miserable, it's because some other baboon has worked really hard to bring that state about. They get stressed the same way as we do.
Is that true of all primates? I mean, we always think of gorillas, you know, like the mountain gorillas, as being so gentle.
Baboons are one of the best cases of sort of westernized style of stress, just because they are on the more aggressive, more competitive side.
Okay.
They do live in these big social groups, and they've got the luxury out in the open grasslands that they really can spend most of each day devoting their energies to being miserable to each other. They're a better fit than a lot of other primates.
So let's talk about surviving stress, and we can then remind people the name of the book is Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. So why don't zebras get ulcers?
They don't worry about public speaking. They don't worry about mortgages. They don't worry about the rainforest. They just worry about lions. I mean, they typify the more run-of-the-mill mammalian experience, which is if you're going to get stressed, it's for 3 minutes long, and then it's over with, or you're over with. They don't have this human, this primate ability to sit there and fret for months on end. They get stressed the right way.
So part of the right way for us, since we fret, is this balance between rest so that there's some recovery from stress.
Yeah. And there's not a whole lot of stress-related diseases where you don't turn on the stress response when you really need to, sprinting for that bus or sprinting away from the elephant. For most of us, what stress-related diseases tend to be about is you have trouble turning off the stress response. It's overactive. Your blood pressure kicks up for too long of a time. You secrete too many stress hormones into your bloodstream for too long of a time. You decrease blood flow to your stomach walls and increase the likelihood of an ulcer too much of the time. We don't have problems with stress-related disease of not being able to turn things on. We turn it on too much, too often, for too long.
So one way to release stress along, you know, we've got all the things like we can, you know, you should rest, you should meditate, you should do relaxation techniques, but there's also exercise. One of the problems with exercise is that people don't realize, or learning new things, that that's a form of stress as well. And if you over-exercise, you completely reverse the benefits. I've talked about this on the air. So one of the things that I talk about telling Blue in the face on the air is to please build rest and recovery into your life, especially if you're, you know, just inevitably under stress. But there's also things like, along with being expressive, the animals that do the best, including humans, are the ones that have some amount of relatedness. And that doesn't mean everybody has the same need for relatedness, but it means that everyone needs some relatedness and that those types of animals and people do better.
Social support is a real important thing. Social isolation is an aching stressor, whether you are a human primate or most other sorts of social mammals. You look at the human health psychology literature, and the single biggest predictor of disease outcome has to do with socioeconomic status. You do not want to be poor in a country like this if you want to have a long, healthy life. The second biggest variable is social connectedness. People who are socially isolated are far more likely to succumb to basically every infectious disease across the board. Okay, what's that about? There's all sorts of confounds that are sort of jump to mind. Maybe people who are socially isolated They don't have somebody to remind them to take their medicine every day. They just subsist on cans of cold SpaghettiOs instead of having a decent meal. Yep, those are variables, but you control for that stuff, and social isolation in and of itself is a medical risk factor. What counts as being socially affiliated, when you look at the human studies, it's having a significant other, a spouse, a close friend, a close circle of friends, a community group. There's no single one that's been proven to work better than others, but being socially connected for any primate is a real important predictor of health.
One of the last things I was thinking about is that there's a state of mind that humans indulge in. I don't know whether animals do. I think animals do it too. The primates seem to think about what they're doing before they do it, and they learn from each other and stuff. But there's, you know, the state of mind that we go into when we're in an engaged, conscious kind of state, like when we're getting ready to do something creative or when we're involved in doing something creative. That's an interesting kind of netherland that's different. I mean, I'm going off the track a little bit, but it strikes me that having some of that kind of engaged time is also a way to take a load off. But it also is an interesting place for the mind to be in. It's an odd sort of place.
Alert, but not threatened. Working at something, but not overly challenged. I think another way of stating that is why at least a substantial subset of people find a good card game or a chess game or some such thing like that in the right setting to be relaxing.
Yes.
We have very playful minds, and we like using them and outside the context of menace.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? I'm going to give the callers a chance to have at you, if you're ready.
Okay.
I'm a health integration specialist. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Dr. Robert Sapolsky, biologist and neuroscience professor at Stanford University. We're talking about stress and his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. We're opening up the phone lines at 510-848-4425, again, 510-848-4425, in whatever area code you're in. Remember that it will just ring if the lines are full, but also the lines free up as we go along. Remember to turn your radio down before we pick you up. Our first caller is Paul from Los Angeles. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hello. I have a question about cancer and stress. It was my understanding that our immune systems help to protect us against cancer. Is that part right?
Yes. And
so then, to continue from there, if stress weakens the immune system, why would not stress then make us more predisposed to cancer?
Okay, great question. And that's been at the heart of a lot of research in sort of this new field called psychoneuroimmunology. Stress definitely does suppress the immune system, sustained stress. So you would come up with this very logical syllogism: to the extent that chronic stress chronically suppresses your immune system, you should be subject to all sorts of diseases that your immune system normally defends you against, cancer being one of them. What the literature tends to show, though, is stress does indeed suppress the immune system, nowhere to the extent, though, where you've got immune defenses impaired enough that cancer begins to be a problem. It's simply not extreme enough of an effect. Stress definitely has something to do with us being more likely to get the common cold or have a cold sore flare-up or even something like mononucleosis. It's just not powerful enough of an effect to set us up for an increased risk of cancer in the first place. Once you have the tumor, most of what goes on biologically at that point, in fact, is independent of the immune system. So at that point, the stress effects on the immune system don't even have an impact. But even in the early stages, everybody keeps looking for this stress-cancer connection, and it's simply not there. We don't get immunosuppressed enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
Let's move on to Chris in East Palo Alto.
Hi. Well, I'm going to follow up on that. I've been listening to the program for a little while. It sounds like the doctor doesn't believe in the data accumulated that by Dr. Simonton on cancer, and I know we were not supposed to pronounce names, but I guess I'm a caller. And I can't.
No, it's fine.
That. And then I have a follow-up question on stress and chronic fatigue, and one way to call it would be to say, or to ask it would be to say, do zebras get chronic fatigue?
They're too smart to get chronic. Forgive me, that's a terrible thing to say.
The extent that we understand it, no. And one of the big problems with something like chronic fatigue is nobody really understands it. I mean, chronic fatigue is just getting in the ballpark as a disease of having most practitioners think, you know, there's probably something biologically going on there. Instead of it being, quote, just in the person's head, there's some hints about some sort of virus, that kind of thing. That's where mononucleosis was 50 years ago. That's where tuberculosis was 150 years ago or so. You see a lot of diseases coming from the hinterland of being thought of as, quote, just psychosomatic. And then we figure out, aha, and there's actually some real biology going on there. Chronic fatigue's just on the edge of that.
And then the other thing about Dr. Simonton, you know, the thing about Dr. Simonton is that he doesn't think that attitude is what causes or protects people from cancer. What he says is that concentration of the mind through various techniques. I mean, he has a tendency to be a bit Christian, but he talks about using the mind as an ally in healing.
Can I say something on that?
Yeah.
Well, I believe that Dr. Simonton has basically relied on statistical studies showing that type A personalities, and in particular type A personalities who had had extreme stress during the year or 2 years, I forgot, prior to the onset of cancer, are actually at the highest risk. I mean, there is apparently some very, very convincing statistical evidence. Now, Well, is statistical evidence enough to say that stress is a cause or that type A is a cause? I don't think he ever said that, and I don't think I believe that for a second.
Well, I interviewed him, and I asked him about attitude and illness, and he was very careful. He was very concerned that people not blame themselves for their illness.
That's right. Blaming yourself would be totally the
opposite. So let's let Dr. Sapolsky respond.
Right.
Yeah.
These are great questions, and that's a very sort of intriguing literature you're tapping into. Two thoughts in there. One is there is a literature out there showing things like stressors, like depression, being associated with increased risk of cancer. That literature's floated around for years. Real careful studies, and these are miserably difficult studies to do, show that in those studies, there's typically some confound there. People in this workplace who had a higher rate of stressful depressions had a higher rate of cancer. It turns out they were more depressed because they were working around carcinogens.
Thank you, and also chemicals and things, environmental
exactly.
pollutants.
Stuff like that, or the studies don't control for smoking or fat intake or things like that that have an influence on cancer. Mm-hmm. The other literature out there that's real interesting is once people do get cancer, there's what is called in the literature a type C personality or a fighting spirit, that people who really go after it and I'm not going to let this defeat me and what do I have to do and I'll do it twice as much. Folks like that do indeed have a longer life expectancy.
That fits with the animal studies too.
Yes, indeed. And what that would suggest is, aha, stress reduction, that has something to do with it. Wonderful work by a psychiatrist at Stanford named David Spiegel showing women with metastatic breast cancer who get put in intensive group psychotherapy have a longer life expectancy. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that reduced stress and your immune system now works better and you fight the cancer better? Probably not. What these studies probably show is people with that sort of spirit, whether they happen to have it just on their own, or whether it's more likely to have it when they're in sort of a supportive group of a bunch of other people going through the same hell, they're more likely to go the extra round of chemo. They're more likely to stick with their drug treatments. They're more likely to make sure they get their three decent meals a day, even though they're sick to their stomach. Mm. That's probably the adherence, the compliance stuff.
Well, but it's also like the helplessness studies. It's the animals who felt they had hope and had a chance were the ones that survived. Chris, we're going to have to let you go, but thank you for your questions. Let's move on to another Paul.
Hi. Go ahead. I can barely hear you.
I'm sorry. Can you go ahead and ask? We can hear you.
Yes, I can. I'm a graduate student, and I'm just now taking a break and turn on the radio, a break from putting together a paper, which is kind of stressful. I'm just wondering about the professor himself, how he uses his research in his private life, if that's okay to ask.
Yeah, Paul, why don't we let you listen to this on the air since you're having trouble hearing us. Thank you for your question.
Let's see. Personal stuff I do. I actually, given that I do research and it's very stressful and long days and all of that, I think I tap into some of the stress management things you're supposed to do. I have a piano in my laboratory, and I sort of try to play it now and then. I exercise daily. I love my work, and that's a huge factor in terms of occupational stress. And in terms of the social affiliation stuff, I have a great marriage. And all of those things collectively, I think, make for, you know, a pretty good picture in terms of stress management.
Okay, let's move on to Will in Piedmont.
Yes, I had a question about unemployment.
Yeah,
what kind of Like I'm in a support group of other people looking for work, and so we're continually networking. But there are some dietary suggestions you can make, or
well,
vitamins.
We could on another show. This is probably not a good show to do this on because Robert Sapolsky is a neuroscientist. He's not a nutritionist or
okay.
a pathologist. But we do lots of other shows about that, so stay tuned, and we'll probably talk about nutritional things that will help you with stress.
No, I will. I like your show.
Oh, good.
The one brief thing I'd say
yeah.
there is, if you want to have a model system that taps into everything we know about psychological stress, try being unemployed.
Yeah.
Terms of no control, no predictability, no outlets. You're often working so hard at finding a job that you lose a lot of social support. It's really a hellish thing, and physiological studies have shown that as well.
Actually, I will say one nutritional thing about stress, since I can, is one of the things that people forget about is that stress, either because you're exercising more or because you're having the experience of stress, as we talked about, it uses a lot of energy, and protein is a repair is the way we repair ourselves. A low-sugar diet is very important to eat, a diet that's balanced, where your carbohydrates are complex carbohydrates, not refined, because that'll get you into trouble.
Right.
Eating very complex carbohydrates and balancing them with protein and making sure your protein intake is throughout the day and is substantial enough to deal with the amount of stress you're under.
I'll try it.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Let's move on to Charles in, Charles in Berkeley.
Hello. Related to the last question is what Dr. Sapolsky mentioned himself. He mentioned April 15th as being a reason for stress. You should know that according to the Code of Federal Regulations, it's only certain income from the Virgin Islands which requires the filing of a 1040 form. You have succumbed to fraud. Please do not promote that as a proponent.
Thank you very much for your call.
Yes.
That's
well,
very much off the subject, but thank you for your comment. Let's move on to Ed in Berkeley.
Hi.
Hi.
This is an appropriate name for me. My last name is Stress.
Literally, your name is Ed Stress?
That's correct.
I love it.
It was a truncated Polish name. It used to be Strzewski. My father thought he would do me a favor and avoid the pronunciation error. And it was funny because, like, in the 50s and 60s, nobody but physicists knew what, engineers knew what stress was, but nobody. And then as the decades moved on, I think somewhere in the 70s, one out of 10 people would ask. And then somewhere in the 80s, the switchover came in about 50-50. And then, you know, in the late 80s and the late 90s, everyone who meets me and knows my last name has to stress. What? Why did you give yourself that name?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I had a question about the zebras and baboons and living naturally or what kind of living. I mean, it's very natural for us to do the type A thing. We're sort of induced to do that by what you said, that the pit waiting for us is unemployment.
Well, and competitiveness too.
Pardon?
Competitiveness.
No, I'm saying if we don't choose that type A personality. So I'm trying to think of like the ideal in the opposite way of not what is it type B, the other way of approaching it, and then I come up with some counter examples, and I'm sure you don't mean, but I'm wondering if you're, you know, on the Serengeti, you work 4 hours a day, and you just hang out and you're a baboon, that's cool. But if you would do that in this world, you'd be called a slacker or a bum or...
Isn't that
a source of stress? I'm just, you know...
All right, so you're asking about societal stress. I'm going to let Dr...
No, actually more, it's like choice of... You know, I know that's not exactly what you mean by the way to approach it, but make a distinction between other, various ways of not being type A.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Ed.
Sure.
We'll let Dr.
Sure.
Sapolsky answer you.
That's actually a good point. One of the great sort of secularizations of our modern day is to be type A verges on the sinful. That's sort of like our moral ledger is how our blood vessels are doing. Oh, type A, that's hostile, that's impatient, what a terrible thing. A universal goal should be to get rid of that. Being type A is wonderfully adaptive in the right setting. If I was sitting in Berlin in 1932, I sure hope I was type A because that would have had a higher increased chance of getting out of there, that sort of stuff. What you see is a theme that I had mentioned earlier. It is not our nature to be competitive and crazy and driven. It is not our nature as a primate to be altruistic and self-sacrificing. It is not our nature to be type A or type B. It is our nature to sort of often try to assess the appropriate social context. And a lot of what these stress-related diseases are about is not, it is always a medical disaster to think this way, feel this way, have your blood pressure react this way. It's just a bad thing in this setting. And a lot of what stress management is about is figuring out appropriate settings. Don't try to control the uncontrollable. Tell the difference between what you can change and what you can't, and that sort of thing. That's what we're real good at as a primate, as a very intelligent one, telling the difference between different contexts.
That's a good answer. Let's move on to Michael in Costa Mesa. Michael, are you
ready? Yes, hello.
Yeah.
I have two questions. The first is about the cancer and effective reducing stress on on cancer recovery. I'm surprised that that doesn't show positive correlations, since if I recall that reducing cortisol levels, which would correspond to reducing stress, would allow the immune system to participate more. Is that not true?
Great question, very informed one. Again, though, the immune system, you really need to massively suppress the immune system, like what you would see in someone with AIDS, before you begin to see, for example, some of the sarcomas that clinicians used to see once in a career.
Mm-hmm.
You need a huge amount of immune suppression to increase the risk of cancer, and that simply doesn't happen with stress. Stressors just are not immunosuppressive.
And your second question, Michael?
Second question is, generally, or specifically, if you wish, how does meditation, in your experience or in your knowledge, affect mind and body chemistry? And is that of use?
There's been good studies with it. Meditation, along with a number of other stress management techniques, will lower blood pressure, lower cholesterol levels, improve the good-to-bad cholesterol ratio, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
There's some dispute in the literature as to whether that only is occurring while you're meditating,
mm-hmm,
versus how long-lasting the effects are. Something real important to emphasize, though, is those studies show over and over and over stress management techniques work. What the studies also show is, be totally suspicious of anybody out there who says it's been scientifically proven that my brand works better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That hasn't been shown. And the key thing is, there's some folks out there, the notion of meditating 20 minutes a day is wonderful for them, and there's other folks where that's their idea of hell.
Right.
You know, we all differ as to what stress management counts as, whether it's bungee jumping or meditating or Bach or playing the trombone or, you know, hang gliding or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, read the ingredients labels on every new type of stress management, but figure out which one works for you.
Yeah.
What relates to my two questions is that there's the an institute in Palo Alto you may be familiar with that has reported that their, I guess what I would call their form of meditation, has resulted in a big increase in DHEA levels and reduction in cortisol levels. Have you run across that?
That's the sort of stuff, one, you know, to not inundate people, one, the cortisol is viewed as a bad stress-related steroid hormone. DHEA, very preliminarily, might be viewed as a good news steroid hormone.
Mm-hmm.
A number of studies have shown stress management techniques to do that. Again, nobody showing their brand works better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've got to let you go, Michael. We've got other people waiting to get on. Callie in Pasadena.
Hi.
A female voice.
Yeah. And one who's sick, too, so I hope I don't end up getting into a coughing spasm.
No. Go ahead, please.
I'm also having some trouble hearing you, so I'd like to just...
ask your question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was wondering, Dr. Sapolsky, if you've been aware of this. I guess there's some new research going on plant polysaccharides. And apparently what I've been hearing is that they... are more important in cell-to-cell communication than, anything else, I guess.
Actually, no, I'm not familiar with that at all.
I guess it has something to do with, a combination of glycoproteins, and I don't really know very much about this, so I may be sounding pretty ignorant, but glycoproteins and plant polysaccharides. And
well, you know more than me. I'll track that down.
Okay, because the question I was going to ask was whether or not it's possible to take supplements that would provide, extra dosages of plant polysaccharides, and that would actually enhance the immune system and general overall well-being.
No, unfortunately not familiar with it, but I will find out about that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Callie, thank you.
Thank you.
I think there have been some very compelling pieces of research about all kinds of phytomaterials, chemicals and nutrients that we're starting to learn about that help. But I still think the most important thing about your book, Dr. Sapolsky, is that in the end, really viewing our lives in a big way and looking at the corrosive effects of stress and learning to make some intelligent decisions about it is, and being informed is really the way to go in terms of protecting us. Dr. Robert Sapolsky, neuroscientist, biologist at Stanford, and author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, A Guide to Stress, Stress-Related Diseases and Coping, published by Freeman, is available in paperback. You have been so generous. We're looking forward to having you back during the pledge drive, and we'll talk about The Trouble with Testosterone, which is essays on the human predicament. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you.
It was such a pleasure.
Same.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, thanks to all of you who participated in the show. It was a lively discussion. A brief reminder, if you want to get a tape of today's show, if you missed parts of the show, or if you need to get hold of me during the week, you can call me during normal business hours. That's 707-769-1458. Again, 707-769-1458. For a list of other available shows, send me a self-addressed, stamped, business-size envelope, please, with two stamps, to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Thanks to Jan Michaels for boarding the show today. Next week, I'll be back with an interview with veterinarian Dr. Alfred